When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey everyone, welcome to the 121st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow.
This episode is brought to you by patrons Kip Adler, Oscar Vaca, David, Artemis, Luke Sheldon, Nathan Blackwell, and Nathan Presley. Thanks for supporting us.
Today we've got Elijah Bynum on the show. He directed the movie Hot Summer Nights, starring Timothée Chalamet. Spoiler alert, guys, Elijah is a bit of a wunderkind. His first two screenplays were on the blacklist the same year. So this is his first feature. It's his directorial debut. It's the first thing he's directed. He's going to tell us all about how that movie came to be and his secrets to his success.
We really got to dig deep on how he accomplished some of the shots, like a cool car accident shot, aerial shots, party scenes. We really talk about the craft of making movies and the business of how to get your movies made and noticed. It's kind of a perfect little encapsulation of what our show's about.
But before we get to our conversation with Elijah, Oren.
Yes?
What have you been working on lately?
Well, Matt, I can tell you what I have not been working on. This is something that I did not even really want to talk about on the podcast, but you...
I pressured you.
You pressured me over the last three podcasts to talk about it. And it is that I was playing this mobile video game. I might have mentioned it on the podcast like once or twice, but I have literally been playing it for over 3 years. I saw my first login the other day.
Did it show you how many hours you've logged on the game?
No, but it's like, I don't think there's a counter that goes high enough in technology.
Because I had a World of Warcraft problem and it would tell you how many hours or days really? You'd logged. Yeah, I bet it's in there.
To me, probably even the more offensive number, more offensive than how many hours I spent playing would be how many times I logged in per day. I would not be surprised if it was over 100.
So you're saying basically that you were addicted to this game?
I mean, yeah. What's weird is like it's a game with a social element. So, you know, you're like playing with like in this game, you're like grouped into alliances and you have 30 people in an alliance. So everyone's talking to each other throughout the day. And in the chat rooms of the alliance, people would like kind of make addiction jokes, but it was no one really would acknowledge that they were really addicted, that it was a problem in any way. Mm-hmm. And I would always bring like up these articles. I'd be like, look, the World Health Organization says video game addiction is a real problem. And they're like, yeah, that's bullshit.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Like everyone was in denial except for me. And I'm like, guys, don't you see how crazy it is that like every time you go use the restroom, you're like logging into this game and like spending your whole weekend and like all this money. I don't know.
Wait, so, did you spend real money on the game?
I did spend real money on the game, but not like an embarrassing amount. Probably over the course of 3 years, probably like $200 maybe.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this game was a type of game where you can either spend 8 hours doing something or $5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there was a free way to get everything. But when it's a competitive game where you're competing against everyone in the world, and everything you do in the game shows you how you stack up against everyone else. Mm-hmm. The word contest is in the name of the game. And because of that, you are in this basically the cycle of peer pressure and these alliances of like, hey, you should do this. You should buy this. You should get this. You should do that. Like this is so awesome. You could be, you're having these great characters. Anyway, whatever. The point of this story is
you were in deep.
I was in deep. It seriously affected my productivity. It was like if I was directing something and it had zero effect on it, you know, because when you get a directing job, it's like, okay, when does pre-production start? What's the script? Let's shot list. Let's go to this location scout, cast, shoot, edit, mm-hmm. done.
I mean,
that's easy. But in between, when you're writing, meeting, mm-hmm. generating ideas,
when your time
getting inspired,
yeah.
If I had like an open hour instead of like reading a book or watching a movie or writing, which is what I should be doing, I was like playing the game. And so I eliminated it. I was really afraid. I heard that quitting like a video game addiction is like alcoholism. Like you can't, like an alcoholic can't say like, oh, I'll just have like two beers a day. Like
right. You
can't scale down.
You have to go.
Have to quit cold turkey.
Cold turkey, yeah.
Because I tried scaling down a bunch of times and then I would just like, whoop, yeah. scale back up. Yeah, so, but it's crazy. You know, you spend 3 years building this amazing account. And there was a time where I could probably have sold it for like $1,000. The market kind of became saturated. Anyway, it's awesome. I am finding that I don't miss the game at all.
Mm.
And I don't know if you ever played like these massive multiplayer games or like had a group of like friends that you only knew in
through,
the gaming world.
The game, yeah.
But I kind of thought, it's not that I thought my relationships with those people are more real than they are. Because they were like, I mean, they were deep. Like we talk to each other 100 times a day. We talked about our kids, about our wives, mm-hmm. about our lives, about our jobs. We'd like share what's mm-hmm. going on. But as soon as we quit, it's like, or somebody leaves the alliance or someone gets disconnected. It's like within a
yeah.
week, it's like, it doesn't matter who they are. It's a weird
yeah.
thing. I think it's fueled a lot by, not endorphins. What's
dopamine?
The, yeah,
yeah.
Dopamine
yeah.
and like, kind of these highs you get from like friends and friendship. And I don't know. It's weird, but I quit. And now I think it's good. I'm working on a screenplay.
Yeah.
I'm reading a lot more.
That's good.
Spoiler alert for your unpaid endorsement.
Yeah. Well, I'm proud of you. Congratulations. You know, it's funny. I think I have a similar relationship to Twitter, checking my email and checking my website stats. Actually, I probably check my website stats 20 times a day. It's directly related to how much I'm working, basically, because you're looking for any sort of validation of like, oh, like people are considering me, like maybe I was close on that one, you know?
Right.
So I get it, man. But
this is actually my second vice I quit this year.
Oh yeah.
My first one was news. Mm-hmm. I was a news junkie. That was, I kind of got over that like last year, mid 2017.
Yeah.
Had a year of like reading the same article in on every website.
Yeah, you were pretty strung out about it. Yeah, our time is so unstructured and our work is so personal. It's really hard. I found days and days, weeks would go by where I wouldn't get substantial amounts of work done because of some sort of
distraction.
Yeah.
We wanted to remind you guys that we have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/justshootitpod. It is the place where if you enjoy this show, feel like you're dying to help us out in some way, want to support us, want to just talk to us or something, go to our Patreon page and you can give $1 a month. It's 25 cents per episode, as Matt says, and it just helps us pay our editors. And we are planning our back to school live event end of August. Details to follow.
It is in the works.
It's in the works. It'll help us pay for that. And it just means a lot to us. And we just sent out our very first monthly newsletter to our patrons. You'll get some insider information about the nuts and bolts of Just Shoot It.
Ooh, and also if you have a suggestion, that's an easy way to reach out to us.
It's like the IMDb Pro account of Just Shoot It listening.
There you go. Awesome. Well, on that note, Lauren, let's have our conversation with Elijah.
So, hey, we are here with Elijah Bynum,
director of Hot Summer Nights.
That's me.
Welcome, man.
Good to be here, guys.
When does it come out?
It comes out July 27th.
Which is the day after this episode drops.
Cool, man. And this is your first movie.
It is. It's my first anything, really. I hadn't directed anything before, a music video or commercial or a short film.
Like
I hadn't,
literally nothing?
Literally nothing, which in hindsight is kind of crazy.
Crazy or impressive, and, depending on how you,
yeah,
look,
depending on how you look at it.
I think there's a lot of first-time directors, but I think it's important for our listeners to know that this is like an A24 film. It's got Timothée Chalamet. It's like a, feels like a big studio film.
It's a real movie, as we
Yeah,
like to
it's not like a $20,000 film school film.
Yeah. Well, it didn't, yeah. It, we didn't know, obviously, when we started making it that it would end up A24. And at that time, Timothée wasn't who he is now. But yes, at least on the page, there was a lot to try to get accomplished. Mm-hmm. And there was car accidents and hurricanes, and it was a period piece. And I think there was something like 70 different locations and 80 different speaking parts. So it was, it did feel like a big movie, certainly.
And can you give us the log line real quick?
Oh, man, the log line.
Or I can do it if you want, because you're probably, I saw it last night.
Oh, you did see it last. You're probably much better at the log line than I am. My log line would end up being 3 paragraphs long.
So to me, but didn't you, well, it was on the blacklist, right?
It was on the blacklist. So they probably came up with a good log line. I should have memorized it.
You should have looked at the blacklist.
Yeah.
Wait, I'm going to look up real quick the blacklist log line.
I think you should try yourself.
Okay.
I feel like
I'll do my log line, and then I'll look up the blacklist log line, and we will see. 2013 blacklist.
Yeah,
it's,
man.
2018.
It goes way back.
Wow.
Okay, so my take on the log line is... Hot Summer Nights starts as a teen love story in 1990s Cape Cod.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And it quickly devolves into a murderous drug spree starring Timothée Chalamet and the girl from It Follows.
Sounds like something Brian De Palma would have made. yeah. Uh-huh. That was pretty damn good.
What does the blacklist say? I'm curious.
Let me see. A teenager's life spirals out of control when he befriends the town's rebel, falls in love, and gets entangled in selling drugs over one summer in Cape Cod.
Yeah, pretty close.
That works, too.
Yeah.
Yours was better.
Yeah.
Yours was sexier.
Well, I think, so I'll admit, I read an interview you did with No Film School.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys talked a lot about how it starts out as one genre and turns into another genre.
Yes.
And so that's why... I feel like I mentioned that in the log line.
Oh, you cheated is what you're saying.
Well,
or you did his research.
I felt like that's part of the heart of the movie that I don't know if I would have noticed as much if I didn't read you guys talking about that. Like, mm-hmm. I noticed it, but to me, it doesn't really break genres. It does start as this teen film, but it starts out pretty rated R, like from the beginning.
Sure.
Like there's all these kids in town talking about the penis size of.
You're saying it's totally consistent, kid. Even if the plot kind of takes.
No, I would say I don't think it changes genres because it's still a coming of age.
Oh, interesting.
Love story, but the tone does take quite a dramatic shift.
Right. Well, it's funny because you it very much starts like a teen movie, like a Napoleon Dynamite or whatever, like that type of genre film. And there's this one character, and it's a super stylized film, right? Like when you introduce a character, you're doing like low angle, like push in, steady cam shots, and like cool. Like it feels, and there's VO kind of guiding us through the opening of the movie. And there's this character that comes that's supposed to be like the badass of the town, like the rebel.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone tells the same story, which is that this guy's killed a man before.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're kind of introducing the idea of like murder. It's like showing the gun, right? Mm-hmm. Right in the opening.
Mm-hmm.
And then.
That gun has to go off in Act 3.
Right. And I think maybe the trope we've seen is like, nah, I didn't, like, I just tell people I killed someone. Or, like, I accidentally, like, got into a car accident or something and killed someone. Like, you subvert it to keep it, like, the teen-friendly movie. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, but in
He's
your movie,
so
you don't subvert
after
it.
After all. But, yeah. In fact, he is.
And pretty early on, you see him beat the shit out of someone.
Yes, he does.
Pretty violently.
Yes.
So this is... This is a buzzy film. People are excited about it. It's getting released by A24. That's, you know, this is the dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of like the indie movie fairy tale. I'm going to cut to the chase. Okay. Tell us how you got this movie going. How did it happen?
Well, it took a long time. A long time.
It's a five-year overnight success,
right? It's a five-year overnight success. It took a long time, but then it happened very quickly at the same time. So I wrote it. Probably it was the second script I had ever written. So I speaking of, you know, genre and tonal shifts, like I thinking back to when I wrote it, I don't think I was aware that it was making the dramatic and tonal shifts that it ended up doing. I was just trying to tell this story that was based on two kids that I knew back in college. Mm-hmm. I wrote it. It had made the blacklist. It was appreciated.
And wait, can we get stop there for a second? Like, how did it? So you'd only written one script before. This is your second script. Did you study film in college?
No. No, I was working. I didn't. I moved out here after college, and just because I wanted to get into the industry, I figured I'd get in. You know, I couldn't act, and I didn't want to act, and didn't. You know, writing and directing was something very foreign to me. So I figured the only thing left to do is be a producer. So that's what I came out here hoping to do. And I found an internship, and that led to a job at CAA. And I worked at CAA for 2.5 years
as an assistant.
As an assistant.
Like on a desk.
Well, it started as like a, do you know what a floater is?
Yeah.
Floater is kind of like a permanent substitute teacher. Like you report there every day, you work there full time, but you're just reporting to fill in for any assistant that is out, you know, sick or just got fired or having a root canal, whatever. And you fill in on their desk. And it's brutal because every day you show up to this desk and the agent, you know, rolls his eyes and is like, who the fuck is this new guy on my desk? Get him out of here. And I did that for 8 months, and then I landed a desk in kind of the charity department. So I was in the building.
Wait, that's a real department?
Yeah.
Charity?
Well, that's how they sleep at night. They have these, they have these, you know, charity events that they give back, and George Clooney does his, you know, oil cleanup, that right. kind of stuff. So I was like, and I did that for 14 months. So I was in the building, and all my friends were working on desks of, like, real agents who repped real writers and directors and real actors. And I felt like I was close, but... Mm-hmm. Not quite right in the circle.
Yeah, that's so funny because you're literally in the building, as we say.
Mm-hmm. Right? Hey, let me ask you an insider question that maybe our listeners would be interested in. Where do like all the agents' assistants hang out? All the CA agents' assistants. If I like just moved here from out of town and I wanted to meet those people, Nick's Martini Lounge.
Maybe it's been a while. Back when I was there, the Den on Sunset, was a big one, and then.
God. They've got a long happy hour, the Den. The Den will have a happy hour till like 8 or 9.
And that great chicken sandwich, by the way.
Oh.
Really great chicken sandwich. And, oh, what's the place right near Barney's Beanery over there in West Hollywood?
Jones?
No.
On 3rd? Not Jones on 3rd.
The name's escaping
Wait,
me.
Wait, the hotel bar?
Yeah. What's the name of it?
Oh, Pally House.
Yep. Pally House. Yeah. Those are the two. One. Those are the two big ones. That's where you can find this. I don't know if that's where they are anymore, but like... 2010, 2011, that was the place to be.
Yeah, because we talk about this on the podcast a lot, but there's this network of assistants that's pretty much like the key to knowing what's happening in Hollywood.
Well, that's how it started for me. I was sitting on this desk and I felt restless and bored and frustrated because I didn't really have much control over my career, what was happening. And I wrote a script out of boredom, put a fake name on it, gave it to the kid who sat next to me who did work for a big agent. And I was like, yeah, my buddy wrote this. Yeah, I don't know if it's any good. Take a look at it. Tell me what you think. And he took, you know, probably like 3 months to read it. And when he finally did, he was like, hey, man, this, you know, this isn't so bad. I think I could maybe get this set up somewhere. And when he said that, of course, I was like, hey, by the way, it was me who wrote it.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
And that was Hot Summer Nights?
That was a script before. It was a script called Mississippi Mud. So once that happened, I figured... Well, that was fun, and he did. He did get it set up somewhere. He called his old boss, and they optioned it, and that, you know, was surreal, just that somebody was actually optioning something that I had written.
So your very first screenplay.
My very first screenplay, yeah.
And had you written shorts, or like, did you study writing in college or anything?
No. When I was much younger, I was into creative writing, like young, like kindergarten, first grade, like that area, all the way through probably around sixth grade. Very into creative writing, you know, creating characters and stories and some kind of way of like articulating a feeling I had and trying to get it out on the page.
So then I'm curious just about, because I know our listeners and Oren and I a little bit are like, what? Your first? Right. Like, but so let me know.
I don't know. To me, it seems like once you get on the blacklist, it's kind of, that's the hard part. But then you're like kind of famous in Hollywood for a week.
Look, man, I'm sure there's plenty of blacklist writers who'd be like, au contraire. But I want to know, what did you do between being like, okay, raw talent, interest, right? And first screenplay. Did you read a bunch of scripts? Was there a particular book you read? Like, how did you crack the nut of even formatting a screenplay?
Yes. Well, part of what I was doing as I was frustrated at CAA on this very slow desk was read everything I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
Watch everything I could get my hands on. Because I realized quickly just how little I knew about the history of film and filmmaking. And sure, I had somewhat of like a layman's idea of what was good. And I had what I thought was pretty good taste. But that was about it. And anytime I found myself in a conversation with someone who clearly like had dedicated years to this, it just reminded me of like how far I had to come. So yes, it was a lot of self-education of reading good material, bad material, seeing what worked and what didn't. And then, yeah, there were two screenwriting books that I picked up. One was called, I think it's like How to Write the Screenplay or something that simple. But it just, you know, the whole idea of the three-act structure and how to write dialogue that's not on the nose. And then it just kind of clicked. It just, you know,
wait, I was like, oh, I get this. How do you write dialogue that's not on the nose?
I don't know. I'm still struggling with it. But at least the book made it feel like, oh, this makes sense. The whole, like, this whole idea of how intimidating it was to write a screenplay kind of, it went away when someone articulated this thing that felt like I understood, but I hadn't quite put it into words yet.
Yeah, you had a little bit of a roadmap now to apply that.
And I was like, okay. And then again, really, and I don't follow this much anymore, but just knowing that there was a 3-act structure and having kind of benchmarks along the way, it felt like the gulf from page 1 to page 120 or 110 was no longer as vast and terrifying when it's like, you only have to get to page 25 to, you know, and then you start over again and you're just working to page 50 and then you're on the back half and then you're just working to page 75. And if you do it in chunks, all of a sudden it becomes much more manageable, much less intimidating. That and reading a lot of shitty scripts written by people who are repped at CAA.
Yeah, that is a gift, right?
It
when is. You're like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. This is bad.
Yeah.
And they're at the top of the pile.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is really
That's what's
empowering.
Awesome about film festivals. You go to Sundance, or not so much at Sundance, but you go to like some other, like an AFI film festival or Newport Beach Film Festival, and you see a short film and you're like, ah, that was awful. I can make a movie way better than that.
It's a weird
and then
way
to make a movie.
It's a weird way to gain confidence.
Yeah.
Is by laughing at someone else's work.
Yeah, yeah. Especially on the page, too, because like there's such a clear comparison, you know, like you go to a film festival and it's like, okay, well, what camera do they shoot on? What budget do they have? Like, what resources are at their disposal? When it's just writing, it's like, it's you and final draft versus another person and final draft. And that is that.
That's right. That.
Yeah. And sometimes, and the really good writers do stick out. I just read, I'm working on a screenplay right now. And so I was reading other screenplays for research and I just read Wanted. Remember that movie?
The Angelina Jolie one?
So that was by Derek Haas, who is now like the showrunner on all the Chicago shows, Chicago Met, Chicago PD. And it's like, the actual movie is quite a bit different from the screenplay, but the screenplay is like really riveting and written. Like it just like pushes you through the slug lines and you're not missing anything. And then I read Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which is by Simon Kinberg, I think. And also it's like so... It's like there's a metaphor there, but it's like so kind of kinetic that it's just like fun to read, which is so most screenplays are not fun to read,
right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
But I want to, again, for our listeners, I want to dive in on one thing that you probably don't care to talk about, but do all assistants at CAA make the same amount of money? Is there like a fixed rate?
Yes, mostly. I think every year you get some kind of bullshit raise. Like $150.
Yeah, like 0.5% or whatever.
Yeah. But then there's this beautiful thing called overtime, which they've gotten stingy with over the years because kids would just sit there till midnight being like, yeah, I'm doing work and just let the clock run up.
Right.
So they got kind of strict with that around the time I started. But overtime's a way to get more money. And then depending on who you work for, if you work for one of the partners, I think they get paid a little more.
Yeah.
And they're asked to do things, you know, personal things, which technically none of us were supposed to be doing, but
kill this person
by tomorrow morning. Bury them.
Is it enough to live off of like an assistant salary?
It depends what you consider living. Sure.
Like in an apartment in West Hollywood with a roommate or something.
Barely. Yeah. Like you're eating a lot of cereal for dinner.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I imagine, Matt went the corporate way a little bit.
I never was an assistant. Yeah.
But it is interesting to know, because that's a pathway that a lot of people have taken.
And there's a lot of writers who've started as assistants, and it can help, because if you write something, you can give it to a buddy of yours and they're actually in the position to, right. to do something with it. Hot Summer Nights got noticed because assistants started talking about it and it got on tracking boards,
yeah,
assistant tracking boards, and then it made its way up to managers and then managers started calling. And but yeah, without the assistants, it probably just would have kind of gone away.
And I'm assuming most of our listeners know this, but the Blacklist is a list of the scripts in Hollywood that the most Hollywood people are talking about, right? So it's like
something.
It shifted a little bit too, right? It started, and you would know better than I would, but it started as like literally like kind of people trading notes, like a formalized tracking board almost. And then now it's like a proper website where people submit and like you can read stuff. And like,
right, but I don't think you get on the Blacklist. That way. I think it's still,
think it's the same,
isn't it a survey of Hollywood execs and their favorite unproduced scripts?
It is. It's their favorite unproduced scripts of the year, and they're all voted on. And if you get, you know, the most votes is at the top of the list and so on and so forth all the way down. But they have started some sort of service now where you can submit scripts.
Yeah.
But I think they've like branded the term Blacklist and they're using it now to do other things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, people are
got,
submitting
like,
scripts.
And
yeah.
Stuff. There's all sorts. It's
getting
an
notes and there's the promise that if your script's good enough, we can find a home for it. There's so they're almost acting like.
Yeah. They have a show with James Spader.
Do they have a show
now?
Yeah. So they're acting like kind of like
I'm
a
just
they're
kidding.
Acting like.
It's a thriller on NBC.
Oh, right.
It's called Blacklist.
You're not 45, which is.
No, I'm just picking up on it now. That was a joke.
Yeah, so that's how you got on the Blacklist, through your agency connections and people you knew. And I mean, look, obviously the script was great, but that's how you got it to the right, to float around in the right circle.
That's how the first script got on. That's how the Mississippi Mud.
Mm-hmm. Oh, was that on the Blacklist
yeah,
also? Yeah,
they were both on the same year. So it was a big year.
Whoa.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah.
Both the same year?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
So I went 2 for 2 that year. Yeah. And I was like, all right, I think I know how to write a screenplay now.
The first
Wait, your first screenplay you ever wrote was on the Blacklist? Come on, man.
And the second, the same year.
How many drafts? Was it your first draft of the script?
Which one? No.
I'm kidding.
Almost.
That's awesome. I'm trying to find the Mississippi Mud. Can I read the logline to that one?
Yes, please.
Everyone knows Blacklist loglines are really interesting.
Knock yourself out.
In the middle of major financial problems, a down-on-his-luck Southerner's life begins to unravel when he accidentally runs over and kills a runaway girl. Damn. Dark.
It's dark.
Wow. That's crazy. And do you know if the same people voted for both?
I have no idea. I'm sure maybe a few of them did.
Wow. So that was 2013. So obviously this is not a normal thing, that the first two scripts you write. Get on the Blacklist. I was just listening to Script Notes today. Do you know that podcast?
I do, yeah.
And they're like, yeah, nothing, like your first 20 scripts are going to be garbage. Just throw them away.
I keep hearing that. And 20 scripts, my God. I don't know. I still haven't written 20 scripts. I've written 8, I think. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, well, good job. I mean, yeah, I would just stop if I were you. I'd be like,
just be done.
100% record on Blacklist.
Retire after my 10th, like Quentin.
Wait, okay, so now let's get back to what Matt was talking to you about. So your script's on the Blacklist. It's 2013. Obviously, you were repped at the time and you got repped off of sending your script to your friend.
Yeah.
And then how do you go from the script that people around town are talking about to actually getting it made?
Well, there was probably a year where I was trying to get it set up, because it was one of those scripts where people around town obviously appreciated the script, but no one wanted to make it for a number of reasons, because of, you know, the size of it and the fact that it was mostly probably going to be unknown teenage cast. Mm-hmm. It's rated R. There was some drug content. It didn't exactly have a happy ending. And for what, you know, for all those things, it also wasn't the most, it wasn't the cheapest script to try to produce. So there's a lot of things working against it. Everyone liked it, but no one wanted to make it. So that was what I ran into for about a year there.
You had to direct it?
No, I wasn't even thinking about directing. I wanted just to see it get made. I wanted to bring another director on. And we went the route at first of trying to get some bigger, more established directors on, and just getting them to pay attention to anything is hard. And then a producer and I started trying to find like young commercial directors or music video directors and have them come on. And it was around there that I mean, I had formulated a very specific idea of what I thought the movie should look like and feel like, and I basically had a pitch of my own in my head of what I wanted them to come into the meeting and say. And they were all very talented directors in their own right, but they came in and they didn't quite see the movie the way I did, and that's when I got this kind of arrogant notion that, like, you know what, I know exactly what I think this movie should be, and fuck it, like, I should be the one to direct it. It was similar to the feeling of reading a lot of shitty scripts and being like, ah, fuck it, I'm going to write one of my own. So that's kind of where it came from. And
were there any, like, really good presentations? Like, did anyone come in with, like, a Rip-O-Matic or, like, posters or, like...
People came in with posters. People had playlists put together. Yeah, yeah. And I felt, I mean, people put a lot of effort into it. We met some talented people who I'm sure would have made a really good movie. But at that point, I had just kind of become possessive over it. And I think I hadn't admitted it to myself yet, but I think at that point I wanted to direct it. I didn't have the courage to tell myself that, or especially say it out loud to anyone else. But eventually I did, and I remember telling my agents I wanted to direct it, and I could just hear them kind of deflate through the phone.
Right, they're like, there goes the money.
There goes everything. But they set me up with a new company they had just shown up in town, Imperative Entertainment, who had a lot of financing and was looking for they were looking for a blacklist script. They were looking for something small that they could make with a young filmmaker that they could, you know, be very hands-on with. And it was just right place, right time.
And were they
gave me the green light.
They were looking for movies around that budget?
Yeah. Yeah. I think they went around to all the agencies and they're like, give us your best blacklist script that could be made for $5 million. And I think that was that simple.
And did they care about stars at all? Like name, cast, or anything?
A little bit, but we were looking at like 19-year-old kids, and there aren't really any stars.
They're either Disney kids or you haven't heard of them yet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we were just trying to find the best actors possible and people that we thought maybe could become stars. Mm-hmm. And
you kind of hit the jackpot.
Yeah, it happened for a while.
Yeah, so you found Timothée Chalamet. He was
I wouldn't say I found him. So he's been in some other things, obviously.
But you taught him how to act.
Yeah. I taught him pretty much everything he knows about acting. I just can't say I found him.
Right.
But yes, he owes a lot to me.
That's cool. So then...
But to clarify, though, you guys, because you shot kind of a while ago, it's been a long road to release.
Yeah.
So he wasn't the
Oscar nominated.
He wasn't Oscar nominated at the time, obviously.
No.
Had he booked Call Me By Your Name? Like, was there...
No.
Yeah.
He had been... I had seen him in... He did a season... He was in season 2 of Homeland, which I thought he was great in. He had a smaller role in Interstellar. He played Matthew McConaughey's son in, like, the first act of Interstellar.
Oh, right, yeah.
When, like, he's in the cornfields and he's, like, dry, you know, that's Timmy. And then he was in, like, a small South by Southwest indie film. And those were the three things I saw of him, and I thought he was great. And he had this, you know, lovable boy next door thing to him. But he also, there was something kind of, I don't know.
He seems smart.
He's a smart kid, but he also seems, there is something kind of devilish about him in the best way.
A little dangerous. Yeah.
A little dangerous. Yeah, kind of like, you know, a young Leonardo DiCaprio is sweet, but there's something about him. It looks like he could get into some trouble.
Yeah. Well, in Lady Bird, he's like...
Lady Bird, he's a like bad boy.
Bad, yeah. Have you watched it, right?
Oh, Matt? Yeah.
Matt's from Sacramento. I know, yeah, but yeah, I don't remember if you liked it or not.
I liked it very much, but I was thinking about Sacramento the whole time, basically. I was like, oh, yeah.
It's Sacramento.
Yeah. or LA.
That's not Sacramento. Sacramento.
Oh, really? Did they not shoot it there?
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool. So what year did you shoot it?
We shot it summer of 2015.
Okay,
we're coming up on our 3-year anniversary. Can you believe it?
Of the filming. Yeah. Wait, so I guess the last thing about getting it made for me is, like, no one ever, like, did they ever say, okay, we got the money, but maybe let's consider a different director shoot a test or prove to us or storyboard or do something to show us that you can direct this movie?
No, they didn't. I just want everyone to know that's never going to happen. Probably again to me or likely anyone else. I got really lucky with them, and they were just...
But did you have to pitch your vision?
I pitched my vision, yes. But as far as, like, proof of concept, it's like, go make something else first. I had tried for months beforehand to like get money to make a short film or a sizzle reel, and I just couldn't even get that going. So in a weird, bizarre way, it was easier to go and make a $5 million feature than it was to try to go and make, you know, a $10,000 short film.
And I wonder if that, if you had like figured out a way to, you know, get that $10,000 short going, if it maybe would have hurt your chances.
Right.
You if know, that short's not like killer, doesn't get into Sundance, doesn't,
because people have been like, oh, yeah, it's okay.
Because you're on a hot streak, right? Like you've got two blacklist scripts, right? This, everybody loves this movie. They want to make it. Like anything that would keep you from proving that you could do it maybe would be a liability. That's really interesting.
It's a good point. Yeah. It is.
But there, people have... Like that's worked for people. Like Josh Trank, I know he...
Sure, yeah, yeah.
They had him shoot like a test of a scene from Chronicle.
I'm not saying shoot a test is a bad idea, but I think that like with a happy ending like this, you know, why jinx it?
So how did you... What did you say when you pitched your vision? Did you make documents and things or reference movies? Or?
Well, no, I didn't know I was heading into a pitch meeting. I thought I was heading into like just a general meeting because that year I'd been going on a number of general meetings just across town and... They had read the script. They had read both of those the blacklist scripts. I went in there and they said, "We love both of those, both of them. We want to make both of them. We heard you're interested in directing. Which one do you want to direct?" I'm not kidding you. And it's never ever happened. So awesome. Nothing has ever been that easy in my life since that moment. And I don't expect it to ever be again. But well, it was just kind of one of those things.
Right, you know, right.
They place, wanted to right make the time. Movie.
I think also, though, it's important to acknowledge that, like, everybody gets a certain set of opportunities and chances, right? Mm-hmm. And not everybody sticks the landing, you know? So, like, it would have been easy to make a bad movie that no one wants to release, right? But you did it. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, luck always has something to do with it, but, like, it's hard to write two great screenplays and also be, you know, working at CAA for a long time. Like, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, maybe you're glossing over that is that hard work.
Right.
That ends
well, you went
off.
To a lot of you meetings I mean? Where they didn't say that.
Sure.
Before that happened, right?
Yeah.
It's not like that was your first meeting.
Yeah. And this is, again, this was, there were many years of rejection and all of that. Yeah, I just felt like that no one wants to hear about being rejected over and over again.
Fair enough. But I guess what I'm saying is
I think
just
when
like,
other people are rejected, they
it
like
feels
to
better
hear.
To be like, ah, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, you don't need to like whine. But I guess all I'm saying is that acknowledging all of that hard work. Right?
Sure,
it wasn't literally overnight.
No. There were many years between finishing that script and actually making the movie.
Yeah.
And then making the movie, there was plenty of, you know, I mean, that was difficult. Mm-hmm. There were a number of people that we approached in various forms of being part of the film. I won't get into too many specifics that, you know, people that we wanted to get that didn't want anything to do with it. And
that, right.
You know, it's there's always going to be someone who's like at a different point in their career than you who feels like working with you might be too much of a risk or not worth their time. And
right.
Was there a moment ever where you second-guessed your decision to direct the film?
It's a good question. And because I didn't think I was ready or because why?
I mean, all sorts of reasons, right?
Like you didn't want everyone, you were like, oh, maybe everyone else was right. Like this is, I am in over my head. Was there ever a moment like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was less because I felt like I couldn't pull it off. It was the feeling it was more like, is this really the movie I want to make first? Because you're going to be judged. Mm-hmm. Before, you know, it's the first movie you make and people are going to kind of, you only get one first feature and people are going to put you into a box.
But I do
based off what you make. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that happens to everyone because you get tired of you're working on this thing for like 3 years and you're like, should I have made like a fast stylized crime caper when I should have done like an adult drama or a kid's whatever? Or
yeah, your taste changes so much over 3 years too, right? You're consuming so much other media and being inspired by other things. And it's like, maybe I did want to be Judd Apatow instead. You know?
Right.
Exactly. So
especially if you're a fan of everything, which is a problem a lot of us have.
Especially because when I had written it, I was still kind of learning what cinema was and what movies were. And then by the time I went to direct it 5 years later, like you said, my taste had changed. I had moved on to different filmmakers I was inspired by, different, I had seen like hundreds of more films since then. And I was, so by the time we're in pre-production, I'm kind of looking at the movie as like a piece of old work that I had done, but still trying to convince myself that I was still in love with it. And, you know, I feel like it's kind of like a marriage. It's like, I don't know, she's changed a little bit, but yeah, I still love her, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to see this all the way through to the end.
Yeah. So I have some questions. Like I said, I saw the movie last night. I just have some technical questions because there's some like really awesome shots. So that you have like a couple times, I guess it, you kind of revisit this shot. It's like an aerial shot where we're flying over what I'm assumed to be Cape Cod. And then we come down to an overhead shot of the car driving. How'd you do that?
Visual effects.
100%?
100%. You couldn't tell? My visual effects artist is going to be very pleased that you couldn't tell.
No, and I don't know if you know this, but I do visual effects.
Really?
Too. Yeah. So there's no aerial in
he
that
also
at all?
Just bought a drone. So
I also own a drone, yeah.
Were you like, you're like, there's no way that could be a drone.
Well, I thought maybe you either married two shots together or, yeah, I mean, there's no, it's a very precise shot, you know, but like you've seen Anton Fuqua do.
Yeah, you thought it was like that. Drone and then you kind of like match the move, basically. Is that what you're saying? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks good. I mean, the lighting's nice. Is it raining in that scene?
Yeah, it's raining. The rain was tricky. Because, like, I don't know, we seem like the same age, like playing video games, you know, in like the mid early 2000s, the way rain looks, it's just this kind of like coming down diagonally and statically. And I don't know, it's always tricky to make computer animated rain, especially when you're supposed to be moving through it.
Right.
So the rain was probably the trickiest part. But yeah, it was one guy in his garage. He built that whole shot. It took him like 6 months.
No way, for one shot?
Yeah. It wasn't
cheap. How much did it cost? I could spend 6 months doing that. Okay, so that shot's awesome. And then you have the shot. It's kind of similar to a shot from Whiplash where there's a car accident. How did you do that? So it's like a car accident from inside the car and it's very violent, right?
Yeah, we had our actor sitting on a car and the car was kind of locked into this rig that was like wrapped around all of its wheels. And then there was kind of like a gigantic hydraulic arm that extended out like 12 feet off to the side. And then the rig would violently pull the car. So the entire kind of cockpit of the car rocked violently to the left. And at the same time, we kind of blew in fake glass. So it looked like there was an impact coming from the side and it would knock his whole body over to the left. And then, of course, green screen in front of him.
And it's not a stunt person. It's like the actual actor.
Yeah, Timmy Chalamet does all his own stunts.
And is it, did you try it out before you had him do it?
No, like the stunt guy did and kind of like banged dazed. His head and came out a little dizzy and was like, yeah, man, it's all good. It's all good to go.
And so that type of shot, have you ever done anything like that, Matt? Like use a giant rig like that?
I haven't used like a hydraulic rig, no. Yeah.
Yeah, me neither. So, but do you say like, this is what I picture? I picture we're in the back seat, we're seeing this. Car gets hit from the side and then you
I pictured something much more elaborate. I pictured the $25 million, like my vision of that when I wrote it was like the camera's chasing behind a car and you see a fucking truck come and knock the car and the car does 13 somersaults off the side of the road.
Oh yeah.
And like day one of, you know, production, they're like, so that's not gonna happen. All right, that's just let that one go. That's not gonna happen. Let's talk about some more practical ways of doing this. So we ended up with that. But I thought it was important to at least get the impact. But if you notice, you never see the car that hits him. It's nowhere to be found because that was just, it was going to be too difficult and too expensive.
Right. Well, it's from the inside. So I thought it was really effective.
I love like an interior car. Like, do you guys remember in Adaptation, they do it as well?
Yeah.
And I love
that one's very violent.
It's so good, right?
Oh, yeah. There's
because they're backing out and you see it coming and then, oh boy, it's awful.
It's nasty.
This brings up another kind of macro question that I had for you. So as a first-time director, you're on set and, you know, like $5 million you said is around the budget. That's a lot of money. And also with car crashes and drone shots and blah, 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 it runs out real fast, right? So how do you decide what battles you're going to really pick? You know, how do you say, like, hey, listen, this car crash really needs to have a ton of impact. So, like,
we're not going to compromise it beyond a certain point?
That's another really good question. I think, well, that was part of the biggest challenge of making the film is because, of course, you want everything. You want it exactly how you dreamed up. And then it's a lot of it is coming down to picking the lesser of two evils. It's which one can I live with? Mm-hmm. You know, which one can I not live with?
Did you have to fight for a lot of that stuff? Like, anyone at some point say, like, can't we just see him driving and then cut to black and hear a car accident and then pick up with the wrecked car?
Yeah, there's always, people are always throwing out those kind of ideas and, you know, your skin's going to crawl a little bit because, again, from where I started seeing the car accident in my mind to where we ended up was already, to me, enough of a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So when they start talking about, like, do we even need the car accident? Can it just, like, cut to black and we hear the crash and then...
So, I love producers, but they are sometimes, they do not care about the end product a lot of times.
They just want to, their job is to just get the movie in the can,
get
something that cuts together. But, you know, to our line producer's credit, this guy named Nate Kelly, the movie probably would not have been finished if it were not for him. Mm. And him and I, you know, he's the kind of guy, he sleeps 2 hours a night. All he eats are gummy bears. I don't know how he's still alive. He's just the absolute machine.
They're the vitamin types. The vitamin gummies.
Vitamin gummies. He's wonderful, and he's probably the only reason we were able to finish anything. But with that said, him and I were at each other's throats the entire movie. His job was to tell me bad news. His job was to tell me, you know, he was the guy who was like, do we need the car accident? There's a whole sequence at the, like the carnival. He's like, do we actually need a carnival? Can't they just be just walking down the street or something?
Yeah, where was that carnival?
It's rural Georgia somewhere.
It's like a real carnival, right?
Like a real carnival.
Like that's Ferris wheel, is that real?
It's real, yeah. That's not CGI, that's actually real, yeah.
I love that shot where they're on the car and the Ferris wheel's in the background.
Yeah. The carnival is passing through town and they were nice enough to let us come up and shoot one of the nights up there.
Yeah, that's a big part of your job is to fight for things that everyone is telling you you don't need. Mm-hmm, and you watch your movie and it's not like a two shot and overs, you know, it's like the camera's moving and there's like like well thought out transitions and there's sound and narration and you're trying to give like a glimpse of the town people in the middle of some other story. Like it's, you know, there's a lot to it. And you could see a much simpler way to shoot that movie that would not have that kinetic energy in it. Not the rock and roll way.
Right.
So it's cool. What can I ask you about a few other shots?
Of course.
So there's a scene where they go to a party at a house, like close to the beginning of the movie, and you do one of those like dream Steadicam shots where you follow Timmy.
The Copacabana shot.
sure.
Yeah, you follow our two main characters and you walk through this Cape Cod house and there's what looked to me like 100 extras wearing like period clothes, all like relatively good looking kids that are like drinking and making out and partying and smoking and doing all these things. And you're going through kind of small hallways and leaving our characters and coming back to our characters and ending up in like a room filled with smoke with people passed out on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt real, like reminded me of like Project X.
Hmm.
And I've tried to do those shots before, but usually I have like 8 extras, which literally 8 extras at a party looks like nobody's at the party. Yeah,
it looks, you're better off with no one.
Yeah. And then you just try to do long lengths. How long did it take you to get that shot going? And how did you direct like all the extras to do things at the exact right time? Like how complicated is that shot?
Believe it or not, that shot was less complicated than it may have looked. But there were other shots in the movie that didn't look complicated at all that were much more challenging. Mm. And it took a lot longer to get right. But that shot, I knew I wanted to bring him into the party with kind of a tracking shot. So it was just about finding the right house, finding the right location that we could do that with. It was also finding a house that looked like a house that could exist in Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. And
because you shot in Atlanta?
We shot in Atlanta. And Cape Cod is a very specific kind of architecture.
Isn't that
kind
of... It's a name of an architecture, right?
Yeah, there's Cape a name Cod of an architecture house. And like the gray clapboard shingles and the white shutters. And so it has a very specific look that you don't really find many other places in the country, especially in the South. The South has like a lot of brick and marble and all that. So that was hard. And everything down in Atlanta was like brand new. Mm-hmm. Everyone's renovated. And so we had to find a big kind of like, you know, East Coast money, a house that felt like old East Coast money that hadn't been renovated. Mm-hmm. And man, it took weeks and weeks and weeks to find.
And what's like, what to you makes the house look cinematic? Like in a way, like a lot of hallways or like kind of various doorways?
I had given up the dream of finding this. I just wanted something that looked like it could have existed in Cape Cod and looked like it, you know, was old money and it looked like a rich kid's parents who were out of town. That's at that point, I'd given up the dream of like the perfect, mm-hmm. the perfect hallway. So we just found this house and we were like, all right, what are we going to do to make that tracking shot work? So me and Javier, the cinematographer, and the Steadicam op, we just kind of walked through the front door and kind of meandered around. And we kind of knew where we wanted the boys to end up because we knew where the preceding scene or the scene coming after would be, and kind of reverse engineered a way to get from the front door all the way to the end door or the end room. And walked through it a few times and we found the route that felt most organic.
And then did you say, okay, like, were you writing down, like, at this doorway, there should be a couple making out, and over here, there should be people taking shots, and over here, someone's, like...
No, we weren't. We just kind of had a feeling of...
Like, how did you get all of that choreographed, I guess? Did you do it yourself, or do you have an AD that helped you?
Well, it was a group of us, because we had practiced the shot a few times, but we had never practiced it with extras, so we had just kind of done a dry run, because we didn't have the extras until the day we were shooting. And then on that day, we have a bunch of people standing around, and we just kind of, you know, move them and place them.
Sure, and you say, okay, we're in the kitchen. We're you guys kitchen. Do shots.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Yeah. And, like, what would the most organic, you know, what
and it
would
was
people
SAG,
be doing?
Right?
Yeah.
So were you allowed to talk to the extras?
Yeah, was I not supposed to?
I don't know if that's a California thing.
I think
or a SAG thing or a DGA thing or what it is.
It's a SAG thing that... ADs have told me not to direct. If you direct an extra, then they get upgraded.
They get bumped. Yeah.
So you can do omnis. Oh. You can be like everybody, you know, woo when, you know, Timothy walks in the door or whatever. You can do that sort of stuff where it's like a bunch of people. But as soon as someone's featured and a director is talking to them and directing them, they would get an upgrade, basically.
Interesting. I thought they only got upgraded if they said a line. Like if they actually spoke.
It depends on how big of a hard ass everybody
is. Yeah, how strict.
And also, this is, I should say, was just an AD telling me
no,
not
but
to
I've
talk
had that. Stress. I've had that happen multiple times. Because I used to, kind of when I first started directing, I would be like, what's your name, Jenny? Cool, maybe you, like when he walks in, you notice
when
him
you
and walk
over. When
you do
non-union stuff, you get in there, you get to like give them a little backstory and like it's fun.
Right,
you know?
But then, I've been on sets where the AD's like, Oren, just tell me what you want. Yeah. And now, like, if I know I have a crowd, like, when I hire an AD, that's the only thing I care about is, are they good with crowds, you know? Because, I've been worked with some really not great ADs that don't make the atmosphere feel real, you know?
Or, honestly, it could also be that you had, like, a smart producer who was like, well, okay, it's a party scene. I've done this enough times to know that the director's going to want to upgrade a couple people, mm-hmm. and they didn't make it your problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could have been that, and I would have never known.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were all those union extras?
They must have been.
I mean, where did you get all those kids from?
We had a extras casting down in Atlanta.
And how many people were in that house? Do you remember?
We may have had 50 that day. It was our biggest day. We had 2 days at that house.
Them?
We were recycling them and like hiding, you know, them. And ones that were featured in another scene were kind of pushed away into the corner for that shot. But they were great. I mean, and I think I've heard extras, and depending on what city you're shooting in, the extras are going to be very different.
Mm-hmm. I think also age is a big difference.
Age, too.
Because all looked, I'm assuming they're all like 18, right?
Yeah, they're all like, you know, 18 to 20, 22, 23.
Yeah.
But just being in Atlanta, I feel like they were just very excited to be there, and there wasn't this kind of ego of like, oh, I'm a professional extra.
Right.
I need direction.
Or they're weird. That's the other thing that happens. Yeah. You get like a 50-year-old who's like, I've been doing this my whole life. And they tuck your ear off and it's a nightmare.
Yeah. I didn't have too many extra nightmares. They're all pretty chill.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so last technical question.
Oh, wait, hold on. Actually, did you stitch together multiple takes on the Steadicam shot?
That was
take, a one-er?
That was take 7 of 8.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
It does not look stitched. There aren't like crosses and like beams or anything. It's like, it looks like the real thing. So there's a lot of weather in your movie. Mm-hmm. It's raining, they're driving, they're in. Is that, how much of that is scripted and how much of that were you like, why are we shooting in the rain again?
Yeah, well, yeah. I think every scene that it, in the movie that it's raining, it's supposed to be. Now there's a lot of scenes that were ruined because we were shooting in Atlanta in the summer and it, you know, there's like a thunderstorm nearly every afternoon. Mm-hmm. So we got cut short almost every day that we were shooting outside, or we would have to hold and wait for the storm to pass through. So, but yet we didn't use any of the natural weather because it's so spotty. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd go from a bright sunny day to overcast and thundering, and then it'd be bright and sunny again. It was just too difficult to try to roll with that and capture that because we couldn't control it. But the whole back third of the movie where the hurricane comes, that was all scripted, and that's, those were rain towers and that was controlled by us.
And was that fun?
Well, it's fun because you're standing back and you're looking at this tower.
Can you tell us, our listeners, what a rain tower is if they don't know?
It's a, it is what it sounds like it is. It's a gigantic tower that sprinkles rain down on you from like almost 100 feet above you. So it looks like, you know, it's raining.
And where do you set up the tower? Do you decide
that's
that?
Where it's no longer fun because it becomes, it's very difficult because these things are, you know, the base of the tower is essentially like a fire truck because it has like a, mm-hmm. I don't know, 800 gallon tank in it. And it's enormous because it has to have a very heavy base to support this gigantic, you know, metal arm that's 100 feet up in the sky hanging over everyone's head. So you have to find a place to park this truck. And it can't be too far away because the arm is only so long. And it also...
Yeah, I feel like there's maybe logistical challenges.
There's tons of logistical challenges.
Like the tower fills up maybe or something. You can't move it around
You can't move it.
And it takes a while. Yeah.
And power lines, are. It's where it gets really...
Have you used one before?
I've been on set for... there was one... We did a Key and Peele sketch where it was like a football game, but they were in the rain the whole time. Mm. And... You know, it was exactly that, but like you would overhear people constantly talking about like, oh, okay, like, well, we only have 15 minutes before we have to refill or you swap the tank out and they have to be primed, all sorts of stuff that sounds gnarly.
Yeah, and it's expensive. Yeah. You know, every time you turn it on, the money is literally draining out of the budget.
And everyone's getting wet.
Everyone's getting wet. It's really loud. Plus we had gigantic...
like you can't record dialogue while it's going?
Yeah, most of that's ADR. Because we had, you know, the rain's so loud, and then we have gigantic, like, 20-foot fans that are blowing, so the rain looks like it's blowing sideways. So you can't really hear anything. You just scream action, and then you're watching as your two actors are screaming at each other, and I don't even know if they hear each other. They're just kind of saying their lines when they think their lines should be said. And you're like, I don't know, it looked good. Their faces looked good.
But you're still dry, right? Like, the spread isn't so big that you can't set a village far
You can
away.
Go hide off, right, yeah, and be... Yeah. But I was soaked because I kept running out there to like, because we'd keep rolling. It was easier to just keep the rain on than shut it off each time. So I'd run out and I'd give a note or two and run back to safety. But at that point I was drenched.
Sure. You're right. Like a poncho and you're soaking.
Just looking like, crazy.
Yeah. You're trying to maintain some decorum in front of your actors.
Yeah.
So you come from a writing background and this stuff is all like really kind of technical and stuff, but from watching the movie, it seems like you enjoyed it. Are you like, what was your experience like? Was that fun to dive into the
technical stuff?
The physics of how you build it.
Yeah, no, I love the making of a movie, the actual, that's why I appreciate all these tech. I've done a day of press today and I don't think there was a single technical question.
What's Timothy Chalamet like though?
There was a lot of that.
That's how we pitch the show, actually, to PR people. It's like, directors are really going to enjoy this conversation.
Because it's not that question.
Because that's usually what we get.
Yeah.
What does he eat for lunch?
Yeah, sure.
What is he like?
You were saying, though, you were having fun with the technical.
The making of the movie.
I do like that. And I remember liking that. I remember going to, like, Disneyland or Disney World when I was a kid and just getting to see the behind the scenes and getting to see how things are made, getting to see the magic of the movies. Right.
The imagination.
That was always exciting to me.
And when you were kind of like, so you would come in with an idea for how you wanted to execute the scene, and then how do you communicate that to your team, and then how do they collaborate with you to actually bring it all to life?
Well, a lot of that is actually figured out in pre-production, mm-hmm. Where the production designer and the cinematographer and I will talk about what we think is right for the scene and how many setups we think we can, mm-hmm. how many setups we'd love to get, how many setups we think we can get, and how many setups we absolutely must get in case, you know, mm-hmm. things start going south. So we have that kind of going in. When you start scouting locations, those usually start changing mm-hmm. because all of a sudden you wanted to shoot a master shot and then, you know, two over the shoulders. And then you realize, like, maybe this master shot's not going to look so good. So mm-hmm. you start adapting and maybe you start with just two close-ups and you pull out to, like, a medium. And so it starts changing based on your location. So you all kind of head into the day or head into each scene knowing what you're supposed to do. And you meet up in the morning and we walk through the day.
And do you rehearse with your actors on the set?
Well, then that's when it changes the third time is when the actors show up. And I remember there was a scene we had mapped out perfectly. We had shot listed it and storyboarded it. And we had scouted the location and we had walked through everything. And then Thomas Jane shows up. And I'm like, all right, Thomas, you know, you're going to kind of start on the front steps and then you're going to say these two lines and you're gonna walk down here and then you're gonna hit this mark. And he's like, I'm not walking off these fucking steps.
Is he like a method actor?
I didn't know where the character stopped and Thomas Jane began. He might have been in character the whole time. I can't tell. What he is he's intense. Mm-hmm. That's what he is. He's very intense. but focused and committed, and it makes you feel like you're making a real movie. Because he's there to do the work. Mm-hmm. And it did. It was a good thing for me. It felt like, I mean, this guy's done 50 movies and TV shows, and here I am kind of telling him what to say and where to walk. And mm-hmm. it's like, that's, you know, shame on me. That's kind of the first-time director mistake, is treating the actors like trained monkeys mm-hmm. instead of walking through the scene with them, seeing what they would do naturally, and then being like, oh, okay, this is what he's going to do. Let's put the camera in the right place. Mm-hmm. And I think moving forward, when I make another movie, that's probably going to be more of the method of approach. Is like, see what they do and adapt versus having a plan and then trying to mold them into mm-hmm. it.
Did you find any other little nuggets like that where you were like, oh, on the next one, I'm going to do it differently?
Yeah. I mean, every day.
Yeah.
Almost every scene, it was like, I wish I could have that scene back. I would do that differently. I think... And then times it would go, you know, it went well, and I was like, let me remember to do that again. And
any specific lessons for our listeners?
Two specifics would be, one is a technical aspect, which is you usually need less coverage than you think you do. And there's very interesting ways of reframing a shot within the same take. So you can mm-hmm. start in a wide, move into kind of a medium and end in a close. And you can do it all in the same take if the blocking is right mm-hmm. and the camera movement is planned out. So then you're not doing three setups. It's kind of moving into one, and it gives the movie, it's more interesting. It's just visually more interesting right. to watch.
Mm-hmm. It does unfortunately require good actors too.
It requires good actors. It requires a good team. But it also, in the long run, you'll be able to shoot more mm-hmm. and you'll spend less time picking the equipment up and turning it around and doing this, that, and the other. Right. It can get tricky in the edit room,
sure.
you know, because maybe you want some more options, but at least from kind of what I look at from like the directing craft, I'm going to try to do that more.
Would you say on that front, like in the example of like, you're in a wide, you move into a medium and then a close, kind of in the same take, would you prefer to change the times in which, or change the cues for the camera so that like you have a longer wide and then
like
less time
each take?
Yeah, is each take the same
camera movement
pacing for the camera, or is it would you change that up?
Would I change? Yeah, I mean, like again, when I had first kind of started doing that on Hot Summer Nights, I was just so happy that it was working, that I wasn't trying to get too cute. I think moving forward, yeah, absolutely. I think you might, you know, have an idea of when the camera should start moving in closer, and maybe it's a little too soon, or maybe you're a little too late. And again, having time to be able to do it over and over again is really helpful. And again, letting the actors guide you there.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, it's funny. I think you're helping me realize a thing that I, as a director, tend to admire in other directors is that ability to not worry about coverage quite so much. You know, mm-hmm. like I tend to shoot things to TV style. Yeah, and it comes from a lot of improv. I shoot two cameras all the time. So, like, I can't tell you how many of my scenes are, like, a master and two overs, and it's boring, right? Yeah. And your movie is the opposite of that. It's got that move, those moves, and it's sexy and fun and whips around. And it's fascinating to see someone kind of stick to those cool shots because those are the ones that always fall off immediately.
Yeah, well, as you know, there's also a limit to how much you're going to do, right?
Sure, of course.
And picking and choosing. So you're not just doing a, oh, look at me, I have a Steadicam.
Sure.
So does everyone, asshole. Yeah. I don't care. Right. So it's part of it is having a little more self-control next time. And
interesting, yeah.
Just finding that balance of when to kind of have a little bit of fun and be indulgent and when to just sit back and make sure the story's being told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's one of those things, every movie you make, you're going to be adapting. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, again, it's actor-based, and it's learning to kind of, especially if you're a writer, learning to let go of what's on the page. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you shoot a lot of improv.
Sure.
Let go. And you may have pored over this scene 25 times and done notes and perfected every comma. And,
but that's what got you the job.
It gets you in there, and it gets the people with the money to sign off. But then you get there and you're rehearsing it, and the actors will look at it once and go, I'm not going to say that. How about this? And their version's just simpler and more honest. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's about not being too precious about it and being like, I think that is better. Now, of course, they're not always right. You know? So sometimes, you know.
What do you do in that situation? Do you do the, like, let's do one that's scripted and one.
You can give them one, yeah. Or you can say, you know,
I think. The producer really wants to get this line.
It depends on your relationship. Yeah. Thomas Jane, I'd always give him one.
Yeah.
Whatever he wants.
He does we'll pack heat on set, though.
We'll do the Thomas take.
Yeah. Sorry, one last question. You have Terminator footage in your movie. How did you get that?
Do you know, I think it was 6 seconds, and it cost us $11,000.
That's
reasonable.
I mean,
it's one of the most iconic movies of all time. You are Matt Barber, an editor that's been on here before. He does a lot of music, his own music supervising on stuff he edits, and he told me, like, stuff from the, you know, 90s and 2000s, like, that's the most expensive music. That's the stuff that instantly someone hears and, like, can relate to across this giant age group. So, like, yeah, like, what movie would cost more than The Terminator, you know?
I guess. I was just to see that price tag for, you know, 6 seconds of footage was pretty brutal, but.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes me think, like, oh, if I made a $25,000 short that was about a kid trying to become the Terminator, inspired by that movie, so for $11,000, I can get that footage.
Well, to be fair, also, it kind of depends on who's making the movie, right? Like, sometimes with music licensing in particular, like, who's asking is part of the whole equation, right? Mm-hmm.
Does A24 get involved in that, or you already have everything signed off?
Yeah, that was before A24. Yeah. That was, we were still in post-production for that.
Cool.
One final question. The movie's coming out. I guess you've had your premiere in that. It premiered at South By already, right?
It premiered at South By, and then we actually had a special L.A. screening last night.
Okay, so how do you feel? Well, what's it like to have your movie play in L.A.?
Wow, what does it feel like? I think it feels, well, obviously it's exciting and special. I think there's a gigantic amount of relief, if I can be honest.
Yeah.
That it's just been, it's been building for so long, and here it is, and it's out there, and there's no more tweaking with it or taking it back, and people are going to see it, and they're either going to like it or they're not. I hope they like it, but here it is, and it's ready to be, you know, I feel like a proud father sending my kid off to college.
Yeah.
You know, it's over. Here it is.
And how wide is the release?
I don't know yet, actually. I should be able to tell you guys, but.
It's coming out in America theatrically, right?
It's coming out theatrically across the world, but I don't have numbers for you guys. Okay. Hopefully I can get those and I'll email them over.
But most of our listeners could go to their local, or can look
it up.
Well,
it depends how wide your listener base is, but I think we're starting in select cities, and then depending on, you know, how it does, we'll roll out wider.
Well, cool. So should we move into our final section?
Unpaid endorsements.
I can talk about two things that everyone already knows about.
Great.
My classic disclaimer. One is for some reason, I had started watching Atlanta before, and I was like too distracted. I was like playing video games on my phone, checking emails, doing everything but watching that show, and I didn't really get into it. But I just started it again last week with, like, out a phone in my hands, just like watching the screen. And it's pretty damn good.
You're paying attention to a TV show.
Yeah, and that's a show where the camera work is, they shoot coverage, but the every angle is interesting. You know, like
it's
if
very
bed,
cinematic. It's a yeah. very cinematic show, yeah.
But it's not like oneers. It's, you know, but, you know, when you have good content, good actors, you can sit on a wide shot through a door frame and have just hear their voice. When you're doing sketch comedy, that sometimes sure. is not
the best.
Or a commercial, yeah, where you need people to see the...
Or even if you yeah, just, like, needing clean singles because you don't know what's actually going to make the cut.
Right.
Yeah.
That's hard. That's the thing that makes it less cinematic.
And so the other thing, we probably talked about this on the podcast before, but I just watched that Steven Spielberg documentary on HBO. Mm-hmm. And I was just reminded of it when you were talking about directing actors and how, like, micromanaging them. There's this part. Did you see it, Matt?
I haven't finished it.
Oh, have you seen it?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
There's a part where Liam Neeson is talking about how, like, in Schindler's List, Steven Spielberg was, like, micromanaging how he smoked. He's like, yeah, move your hand, and now let's see that wisp of smoke under right. there. And move it. And Steven Spielberg doesn't smoke or anything. And Liam Neeson's like, who is this guy that's, like, literally, he was getting so annoyed right. by how he right. was directing the wisps of smoke from his cigarette. And he was complaining to, like, Joe Fiennes or something, someone else in the movie. And the guy, whoever he was complaining to was like, just trust me. Like, just listen to him. Don't get mad. He knows what he's doing. And I thought it was interesting to hear that, like, Liam Neeson was annoyed by Spielberg's directing right. style. And then yeah.
also,
learned
Spielberg
to trust him.
Was already Spielberg at that point.
Right. This is not, he was yeah. not some young schmuck.
I yeah, mean, yeah, yeah, yeah. He He'd already legend. Made Jaws like 10 years prior. Yeah.
Right, right, right. He wasn't a nobody, but I like, that's what I like about it is that even Steven Spielberg annoys some actors, you know? Yeah, yeah. Like, so if you're annoying some
actors. Every actor has a limit.
Yeah, I'm not saying no that matter who you should are. Annoy yeah. them, but I'm saying nobody's perfect. I think we look at, like, these big directors sure. and be like, oh, they must have some secret way of connecting with people that I don't have, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
and sometimes they don't either. They're directing wisps of smoke.
And it's worth it.
But that documentary is worth watching just because there's these scenes from E.T. where he's, like, directing the child actors and... Just watching him talk to the kids and how he's directing them is, like, fun. And it, like, kind of made me want to work with kids again. So, because he's, like, acting like a kid. He's not talking down to them, but he's just genuinely emotional and excited and, right. while he's directing. And it transfers into his actors in a way that's interesting. And I think you don't think of Spielberg as, like, a super emotional guy.
Yeah.
So, check out the documentary. It's on HBO.
Elijah, you got anything?
My turn. Yeah. yeah. I was thinking I have, there's two podcasts I listened to recently. They're very popular, so I'm sure a lot of listeners
Caliphate.
Have heard them. No, is that what is that?
Oh,
should that really be my good. Next obsession?
Yeah,
is well, that you'll hear you'll, endorsement by you?
Yeah, last week you'll finish it in like 2 days. It's a New York Times one about ISIS.
Oh, that sounds
it's really
great.
Good.
Well, this one there was one I listened to a few days ago called Dirty John.
Oh yeah,
oh yeah,
that's a good one.
I love that times. One. Yeah. yeah,
which I heard Bravo's turning it into a TV show.
Yeah, my only problem with Dirty John. Have you listened to it?
I haven't. No.
I feel like I've heard that story 100 times before.
Well,
the con artist.
The con artist, bad dude thing, yeah.
I did read there was an Atlantic article about that guy and then a handful of other people as well. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like a deep con sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And it almost feels like a film noir, kind of right. like a cheap airport film noir. Mm-hmm.
But Matchstick Men is kind really of that happened. Story too, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
different.
I mean, the character and kind of how he manipulates people is obviously very familiar. Mm-hmm.
But it's real.
But it's real, which is why it gets away with it.
And the end is, like, pass. Pretty
the end
insane.
It's unbelievable.
It's like third act, like, escalation.
Like, if it was in a movie or a book, you would roll your eyes. Because yeah. you're like, fuck you, that didn't yeah. happen. And then there's another podcast, which the name is slipping me, so I don't know
S-Town.
If this counts. No. This one's newer. It's about a boy. I saw S-Town. That was heartbreaking. It's about a boy who... vanishes from a small town in Minnesota in 1989.
Oh.
And was missing for 27 years, I think it was, or 30 years. And finally, the killer came forward recently, a few weeks ago. But they were in the middle of investigating what had happened to him. And they were, like, on their last podcast. And after 30 years, the killer came forward and was like, yeah, it was me.
He's like, I love the podcast, guys. By the way,
it was me. But it really
available for interviews, you know, if you want.
It's really well done.
Do you have it on your phone? Can you tell us the name?
Let me see if I can find it.
It's like, did you guys watch The Jinx in real time?
Yes.
Yeah, that you had to watch in real time, unfortunately. But what happens at the end is, like, in real time. It's like my, that same type of thing.
Oh, it's called In the Dark.
In the Dark. Cool.
In the Dark, season one. Yeah.
Here awesome.
Podcast on a podcast.
Love it.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I read a book, you guys.
What?
I haven't read a book. And so that's actually my real endorsement. It's like, I
think
feel
you
like.
You endorsed that already.
Reading a book?
Books? I think so, didn't you?
Maybe somebody talked about it. It's worth being reminded. Like, it's so rare that I do it because, you know, we are so busy and, like, you're trying to catch up on everything and, you know, you're trying to be conversant in, like, what people are watching and listening to. There's so much. And I found that I just was never reading fiction. I would read a ton of nonfiction, but, like, it just didn't happen. So I read A Wolf in White Van. Have you guys read that book?
No.
A Wolf in White Van?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about a guy who... it's pretty dark. So he attempted suicide as a kid, basically, and like has like a disfigured face, and then creates a mail order role playing game where people will mail in and like you know, it's kind of like Zork or any of those text based games, but over the mail. And it's like this very internal kind of dark story, but with a lot of like cultural touch points and like metal and sci-fi. He's obsessed with Conan the Barbarian and just this kind of like, you know, contemplative, sad internal story. That's like, it's like a novel. It was like a New York Times bestseller from a couple of years ago. But you know, like a quick enough read and like, you know, in the world that a world that I understood, and it was just like, oh, it's nice to kind of be back in that sort of mind frame of just a story you could only tell as a novel, basically. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Cool.
So Wolf in White Van, and
it's a great title.
Yeah. So it's like, cause there's this whole metal subplot. And like when we were kids, you know, people would talk about like, oh, if you played a record backwards, it would have secret satanic messages. And it's sort of inspired by these kids who listened to Judas Priest and then didn't actually commit suicide. So, but the secret message that they're talking about is just these metal singers saying "Wolf in White Van" backwards is what the message is.
Oh, I see.
So anyway, yeah, it's really great, and I totally recommend reading.
Reading.
There are classes all over town on how to do it.
Yeah, I just never do.
I know, there's all these writing classes. Where's the reading classes?
Busy making podcasts. So
you're in a book club too, which is strange that you just figured out reading recently.
Well, the secret of that book club is that like they do very short stories.
Oh. Cool. Well, awesome. So if we want to find out more about your movie or you, is there a website, Elijah, or a Twitter account or some place we can find out about what's happening next with you?
With me, what's happening next? I should probably start using Twitter, shouldn't I?
Or
I
have an Instagram.
I have an Instagram account. I you know,
Elijah
check in
Bunyan?
On once every 3 months. But yeah, you could find me there.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah, and if you guys have any comments or thoughts or questions for Elijah, we'll pass them on to him. You can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, everywhere at justshootitpod. I'm on Twitter. I'm at SmiteyPyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow. This episode was edited by Christopher Robert Gray. Our producer is Madeline Rosewatt. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music you're listening to right now is by the artist Jazar and provided by the Free Music Archive.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
bye.
Everyone.
Thank you.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.